Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the Glasgow Centre for Population Health, supporting new approaches to improve health and tackle inequality. This podcast is the third of three FINS webinars focused on the impact of, the context to, and the emergence from the COVID-19 pandemic. FINS is the Public Health Information Network for Scotland, and the webinar was organised by the Glasgow Centre for Population Health and Public Health Scotland as part of the ScotFO collaboration. This podcast was recorded live via Zoom on Thursday the 1st of October 2020 and includes a talk by Emma Congreve of the Fraser of Allender Institute, University of Strathclyde, on How Did We Get Here? The Problem That COVID-19 Has Laid Bare, and David Ray of the University of Edinburgh on Realising a Green Recovery.
Welcome everybody. This is the third PHINS webinar in the 2020 series. My name is David Waite. I'm a college fellow in urban studies at the University of Glasgow. I'm sure a number of you will have been to the prior series seminars before, but just as a bit of a background, the PHINS is the Public Health Information Network for Scotland. And the seminars have been going for 20 years, but this is the first virtual seminar series. They have been organised by the good folk at the Glasgow Centre for Population Health and Public Health Scotland as part of the ScotFO collaboration. So there are three separate but linked online webinars focused on the impact of, the context to, and the emergence from the COVID-19 pandemic. And this webinar focuses on the latter, that is emerging from the pandemic. There has been much talk in policy circles and in the media about the shock of COVID-19 and the opportunity it may present for a policy reset. How, for example, do we not only build back, but build back in a way that doesn't sow the seeds for further crises in the future? Hopefully this conversation gives scope for such a broad agenda to find expression in the Scottish context and indeed in the different regions and places across Scotland. Okay, so to introduce the speakers, our two speakers today are Emma Congreve from the University of Strathclyde and Dave Ray from the University of Edinburgh. So starting first, Emma Congreve is a Knowledge Exchange Fellow at the Fraser of Allender Institute, leading the Institute's work on poverty, inequality and inclusive growth. She has previously held roles as a senior economist at the JRF, Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and as an economic advisor with the Scottish Government. So with that, over to you, Emma.
So I'm planning to talk today a little bit about the coming out of the crisis, whenever that may be. So as we move now into the second 6 months of COVID-19 restrictions in Scotland, what have we learned about the ability of our society to mitigate the impact of the fallout of the pandemic? And what can this tell us about the future? So at the Fraser of Allender Institute, we're an economic research institute, but have been doing lots of work during the pandemic to understand what's going on and the impact of some of the developments on the economy, but also importantly on individuals and households. So that's a lot of what I'm going to talk about today. And this is unlikely to be the last pandemic we see in our lifetime in the UK, or there will certainly be other crises that will no doubt afflict our economy. So just as improving capital reserves in the banking system was a really key focus post-financial crisis, what do we need to understand about the weaknesses that this crisis has exposed to ensure that next time we don't repeat the same harm that has been created by this crisis, and hopefully have improved living standards between crises as well. So I'm going to think about what the lessons are that the government should be heeding this time round. And I'll be talking about both the UK government and the Scottish government, but there's quite a lot of overlap between responsibilities on many of the things I'm talking about. So what are the lessons that we've learned, or as my title says, what are the problems that COVID-19 has laid bare? So I think part of the answer lies in the decade or so that came before. So I've got two charts here, one on the poverty rate, UK and Scotland, and the other looking at components of income for people in poverty. So if we look at the past decade, where we have gone through a period of adjustment in terms of austerity, Poverty rates have risen slightly, but perhaps not on the scale that many people thought they would due to the impact of welfare reform. And this is partly because employment has been so high, and in fact, earnings were increasing at the bottom end of the income distribution. So is that a success? Well, employment has reached record highs, and we've heard a lot about that in the past few years, but there have been increasing concerns over the quality of the jobs created and the impact on the well-being of households who are relying on unpredictable hours and pay. Zero-hour contracts and precarious work is not necessarily guaranteed. So in a lot of cases, this has meant that there's not much room for manoeuvre for many households. For example, little opportunity to gather savings. Analysis that we did right at the beginning of the crisis, looking at a wealth and assets survey data, showed that only 42% of Scottish households in the bottom income decile would have enough income to cover 1 month of their regular income from savings. And at the same time, the generosity of the social security system has been being eroded. So that puts us in a bit of a scary place for an economic crisis. But the resilience of households and their financial situation is very dependent on poor quality jobs in a lot of cases in the labour market. And we certainly have had an economic crisis. So this is Scottish GDP data that we have so far, and the scale of the fall in quarterly growth in GDP has been like nothing we've ever seen before. This chart doesn't go back to the financial crisis, but it's significantly more severe than in that situation. We will start to see growth in the next wee while, because you know things were so bad that any improvement on the lows that we saw in that quarter two will show up as growth in terms of Scottish GDP, but the levels will be far, far below where they would have been obviously without this crisis. And this is feeding through already to unemployment. So this is Experimental Claimant Count for Scotland. And this is, as I'm going to talk about a little bit later, is probably only part of the story in terms of unemployment. So thinking about the social security system and what I talked about here is the social security contract that seemed to appear at the start of the pandemic. Pre-pandemic, we had out-of-work unemployment support at its lowest ever level as a proportion of earnings. And it has obviously been eroded over the last 10 years quite significantly. But then we saw the UK government step up its support available quite significantly. So the two main changes, there's three here, but two of them are in the same category. So the first I'll talk about is the increase in the standard allowance available under universal credit by £20 a week. And then the second were these two new schemes brought in by the Chancellor, one called the Coronavirus Job Retention Scheme for employees and the other a self-employed income support scheme. So did this represent a new consensus, a new coronavirus social contract? Because it was widely agreed that this was the right thing to do, that households should be shielded as much as possible from the economic fallout, from factors completely out with their control. And it did stand in contrast to what has come before in the past 10 years. So why did that happen? One explanation was the nature of the crises and that it was very much hoped it would be short-lived. And some businesses have started to reopen. And therefore, keeping employees attached to their jobs was a really good idea to do, so you don't have to go through re-recruitment and all the costs and the loss of skills that you would find if you had to start over when your business started to reopen. The second explanation is that sort of more related to the social contract, that given the scale of the shutdown, the falls in income for people who were going from their normal salary down to universal credit levels, even with that £20 increase, would have been so much of a shock to the system for so many people that it would have just created a lot of damage and just wouldn't have been acceptable by the population. So not only would have it also impacted on the sort of financial well-being of those affected, but it would also have had secondary impacts in terms of aggregate demand in the wider economy. So there were reasons within that why these schemes came in and were so generous in a lot of cases. But not all were afforded the protection. People did sort of fall through the gaps, and not all people on benefits got the £20 increase. It was only those on universal credit and tax credits. It didn't extend to some of those older legacy benefits, such as job seekers allowance. So it was a partial social contract, if that's what it was. And indeed, as we're seeing now, a lot of these schemes are being sort of rolled back, as you would probably expect with a recovery underway, but we are still mid-pandemic. You know, we're not out of the woods. So many people do think some of this is premature, but we've got the job retention scheme ending and the job support scheme coming in, which is less generous, and most people do think it will lead to significant increases in unemployment for jobs that just, for workplaces where people just cannot come back in and do a decent amount of hours. And we don't yet know what will happen to the £20 increase in universal credit. There was a letter that went out from a number of charities to the UK government yesterday asking for it to be continued, but as yet we're not sure if it will continue post April 2021. So I mean, what does this all tell us for the future? Was it just a temporary reprieve for people who lose their job due to factors out with their control, or will we have a new kind of consensus that will come through what we all still see in the next 6 months, which is a lot of change and a lot of people losing their job? It's really hard to know. But what do we need to think about in terms of the importance of financial resilience and stability for people going into crises in the good times and going into the next crises? I think it's a really important thing to be thinking about. So before I just talk a little bit more about some of the future impacts, I'm just going to touch on another area of work that we are looking at the Fraser. So we started a program of work looking at adults with learning disabilities. And again, this is an area that's seen quite a lot of financial pressure over the past 10 years, that's maybe not left it in the place that we would hope it to be. And what is clear that as a lot of services have just disappeared for people during the pandemic, as resources have been moved in order to sort of tackle on the more of the front line of the pandemic related issues. And these services had already been reduced quite significantly. And these services are maybe not the kind of the statutory services, but they are the services that help people sort of navigate their everyday life. And for people with learning disabilities during a pandemic where there is so much public health messaging to understand, so much kind of change going on in terms of services being open or shut, or there's just so much to take on board and to handle. They found that that's the support that helped them to do that, to navigate everyday life, has been the services that they've lost. So you can see from this chart that a huge proportion of people have just had their support stop completely. And one of the people we spoke to just described these services as that it's a support that helps, that enables them to keep a roof over their head for himself and his son. He has learning disabilities and he needs that support with his financial situation in order to keep on top of things. So what harm are we creating here? And what is the burden that's being put on unpaid carers where they do exist? Not every person with a learning disability has a family member that can step in and care for them. But where there are unpaid carers, they really have been picking up a lot of the work that was otherwise done by these services. So these data, and this quote is from a survey done by the Scottish Commission on Learning Disabilities. And there is that question of what harm are we creating here and how long will it take? What needs to be done to get people back on an even footing? And I mean, a question for me as an analyst is what kind of analysis went into these decisions in terms of what services to scale back and what to continue with? It all happened so fast that I'm not sure all that much was done at all. So just to finish up with some conclusions. There was a very clear kind of move towards a hopeful debate on Building Back Better that we saw probably quite near the start of the crisis, and some of that has met reality a bit, and as we've seen what's been happening, particularly with the UK government, it doesn't feel that, you know, big mass change is necessarily on the cards in terms of some of the social security support, or in terms of a continuation of expansion of the state. I might be wrong on this, but that feels like where we are at the moment. So where do we need to focus on this Building Back Better debate? I mean, getting the basics right would obviously be a start. I mean, we've seen a huge increase in food bank numbers, and just getting those basics in terms of food and shelter, that shouldn't be beyond us. And, you know, arguably these are the most important things to get right. So that doesn't necessarily mean new and exciting policies. It doesn't necessarily mean a complete replacement of systems. We do have a lot of the right infrastructure in place. I might be unpopular saying this, but universal credit as a system, as an infrastructure, isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just the way it's been, it's run. It's where the priorities are set in terms of the conditionality and the adequacy of the payments that exist through it. But it doesn't necessarily mean we have to throw it all away and start again. We just have to assess priorities and try and make that marginal change where it will actually make that biggest difference in people's lives. I think that kind of returning to understanding long-term implications of particularly the prevention agenda, which has been such a key part of Scottish debate for many years, but where, given we've just had a health crisis and we know that health inequalities have exacerbated a lot of the impacts, we do need to be reminding ourselves and policymakers of the importance of prevention as we go on. And it is, of course, Scotland does have difficulties in terms of being able to, do exactly what it wants to do. We have our own tax raising powers, but we are also constrained a lot by what the UK government decides to do in terms of whether they're going to borrow extra in order to increase support in devolved areas, which would then transfer through the Barnett formula. So there are constraints there in terms of budgets, but we still have a budget of, revenue budget of 35 million in Scotland, 35 billion, sorry. So we can make choices. The government does have to prioritise, and they do have to justify those priorities. And hopefully the election next year will give that opportunity for some of that debate to happen. So that is all I wanted to say, and I'm going to pass back now to David.
Thank you. So with that, I'll pass on to our second speaker, Dave, and over to you, Dave.
So thanks for having me along for this. So I'm going to talk about, as it says, realising a green recovery. So as a climate change scientist, it's been it's really interesting now giving talks, because normally they are a little bit bleak. Doing something which combines climate change with COVID is, a perfect recipe for bleakness. But hopefully in my 20 minutes, I can point to some, I guess, silver linings in the year to 18 months to come. So I guess, starting off with a fairly bleak outlook, we've got this perfect storm of a global pandemic, but a climate and nature crisis still going on. So climate change, as thankfully our politicians seem to be aware of, hasn't gone away. What we've got as a major risk, and Emma referred to some of the context to this, is that COVID-19 is exacerbating some of the inequalities in our society, and potentially really undermining our progress to tackling climate change. So the Paris goals of keeping global temperatures to less than 2 degrees of warming, they're still there, but obviously attention has been very much diverted away from those. And there's a real risk, as we know, that we put effort into recovery, which is kind of completely justified in terms of immediate actions, but actually locks in a future where we can't meet the Paris goals and we actually face much more severe climate change impacts. So one direct consequence we've had of COVID in terms of, I guess, the climate policy world is COP26, so the Conference of the Parties 26, it's a big climate change meeting that should have been in Glasgow next month, and it's been postponed until the first 2 weeks of November next year. And that meeting was crucial because it was essentially the test point for all nations to come together and say, are we doing enough? Are we on track to meet the Paris goals? How can we up our ambitions? And the truth is that we're nowhere near on track to meet the Paris goals, and that was before COVID. And so we've got this big green recovery question. Actually, as we recover, can we recover in a way which doesn't make the mistakes that we had after the financial crisis in terms of just going back to business as usual and locking into high carbon futures? But actually, can we make that recovery a green one and align it with tackling climate change and the nature crisis? And so there are signs that some governments and certainly quite a few organisations are trying to do that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about where I see as the major kind of challenges, but also opportunities. So this picture is, I guess, one of the conversations that we're having with our students at the moment, who obviously are back at uni, albeit under strange circumstances, is about, all right, the climate crisis hasn't gone away, but surely we've got some major benefit in terms of emissions by global lockdown. So the lack of travel, people staying at home, you know, less energy use, you know, scenes like this around the world. And when we look at the data, so I'll just show you analysis from my colleague, Piers Forster, it's kind of amazing in terms of the kind of drop in emissions we've seen around the world. So this is, you know, you can see the lockdown in China initially and their emissions going down and then the rest of the world following. So we've seen this huge drop in carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel burning, mainly from transport, but also less energy being used for our offices and schools, etc. So that kind of makes you think, well, we've had this awful, obviously, pandemic impact, but actually it's cut emissions. So you know, that's a bright side. The key with this, though, is you can see on the right hand side, and these data only go up to towards the end of the summer, that as we come out of our lockdowns, the emissions go back up. So it's that kind of, it's not like, you know, we are staying at that lower emission level. But more importantly for carbon dioxide is a 1 year blip really doesn't have a very big impact. So it's a big drop, but it's in an ocean of CO2. So this is from the mid 19th century, how much CO2 is emitted into our atmosphere globally. And you can see how it's increased as we've industrialized around the world. And as you can see on the top right there, the estimate is that massive drop that we've seen in 2020, in terms of the cumulative carbon dioxide, because it lasts for many centuries in the atmosphere, will be about 0.1% drop. So this kind of, even though it's a bit of a techie figure, basically what it's saying is we need to look at the coming years and actually achieve the kind of carbon dioxide reductions we've seen under COVID lockdown globally. We need to replicate those each year from now on, but obviously not with the kind of restrictions that we've had under COVID. So it's kind of made quite stark how far off track we are in terms of, like I say, meeting the Paris goals, and that we can't just, you know, rely on this year having been like a good one for carbon dioxide, even though it's been bad for pretty much everything else. So some crucial sectors to make that recovery one which does align with the Paris goals does mean that we keep on reducing global emissions. So these are sectors, and I put some in brackets because the green recovery applies across all sectors, but some of them are particularly important because they're kind of high carbon sectors, so big emitters. They're also high risk, either from COVID itself or from the transition that we've got to have to get to net zero. So the energy sector is one that's been in the news a lot based on the oil price and that putting a lot of jobs at risk. But that was already a sector that was transitioning really fast, that really needed a lot of rapid change from its current operation towards being part of obviously renewable generation So one of the things we're seeing in Scotland, for instance, and particularly in Aberdeen and the North Sea, is employers there and the energy companies looking at their trajectory and their workforce, looking at technologies like carbon capture and storage. This is where we capture carbon and put it back underground, looking at the hydrogen economy and looking at where actually employment and reskilling in those areas can buffer some of the impacts, of COVID and the big downturn in terms of oil price to actually secure those livelihoods and align with net zero. The other one, which is really obvious for all of us, is transport. So, you know, the impacts we've had in terms of public transport have been really acute, but also just in terms of how we get around. So, you know, the home working, all of us now on this computer, on our computers, rather than traveling to get together. And that has its downsides, but also has big implications for emissions from transport, for employment as well. There are real opportunities in that sector too, as we electrify transport, actually to make it lower carbon, but also through green recovery, to look at where we're getting it wrong on transport at the moment in terms of those inequalities between rural and urban areas. Can we use rural hub investment in terms of online facilities, better broadband connections, which is a real issue for a lot of Scotland still, and actually use a green recovery, not just to address climate change and to get us through COVID, but actually, again, as Emma said, address some of these fundamental inequalities and weaknesses in our system in Scotland and the UK. Another sector, so I'll mention these relatively quickly. So buildings is a major one, particularly because it's a source of a lot of emissions, particularly heating our buildings in Scotland and the UK. Our buildings on average are not very energy efficient. And we're seeing a big opportunity there in terms of investment in training and jobs around energy efficiency and building retrofit. So there's a real opportunity for that sector, actually, again, to give us a buffer against the employment losses from COVID, but also align with net zero. And the final one here I'll mention is land use, because it's dear to my heart. And it's one of those sectors which is really facing the perfect storm. It's a sector where it needs to deliver a huge amount for net zero. So we need agriculture emissions to fall substantially, but also our land use generally to sequester a lot of carbon. So we need more tree planting, peatland restoration, more soil carbon sequestration. But it needs to do all of that in the context of leaving the Common Agricultural Policy and leaving the EU. So the challenges for that sector, for employment and for alignment with net zero, are huge. For all of these, and this is completely my bias, so I admit it, but it's somewhat, you know, based on the evidence, and I'll put up a link after the talk that backs this up, is education is actually core to the green recovery more widely, but in terms of addressing the alignment of these sectors with net zero and with securing livelihoods, protecting jobs. So just as some examples that I've called climate emergency skills. So the kind of skills that we knew we needed to expand on before COVID, but have become really acutely needed, given the context that, yeah, like I say, we need to buffer livelihoods from unemployment due to COVID, give opportunities, particularly for young people who are being disproportionately affected in terms of opportunities. So expansion of training and apprenticeship. We've seen that the scheme from the Prime Minister just recently announced down south, and in our programme for government in Scotland, again, a lot of emphasis on giving more opportunities. One of the key things the UK government hasn't really overtly done yet, but the Scottish government has done, is actually align this with green skills. So we know that it's a great return on investment to invest in education, we've got these big skills gaps looming. But actually, the green skills narrative of aligning with where we've got to go on not net zero and transitioning these sectors to something which is more sustainable, actually, that's a really powerful focus, I think. And it's been great to see that narrative coming through quite strongly, like I say, in the programme for government. Mixed in with all of this are things like online access. So again, in terms of that accessibility, that equity, being able to make sure people can actually access education which is relevant to them, it's free at the point of use, And that, yeah, if you're trying to juggle care and work, sometimes online access can give you that little bit of extra flexibility that you need. There's a real role for this, obviously, in terms of looking at the climate relevant skills across school level and CPD, so continuing professional development for people who are in work. And I think one of the big jobs we've got in higher education and further education is to look at our role in this. So obviously we're being affected by COVID like all sectors. It's given us an opportunity to think about online learning and our provision, but it's also an opportunity for us to ask the question, are we aligned with a green recovery and for what Scotland and the UK need, not just right now, but in the years and decades to come. So one of the things that we've been talking about as part of a network of educational institutions is actually a green skills action plan. It's actually looking at what we provide at the moment. Have we got what is needed, like I say, to actually meet the needs of new students, of people who are upskilling, people who are maybe making that transition, if you're an oil worker, to carbon capture and storage? Have we got that capacity? Really importantly, have we got it in the right place? Have we got it so they can access it locally? Because these things, you know, are, you know, there's regional diversity, as we know, in Scotland and the UK, in terms of where the jobs are required and where people live. And also this question about time. Are we putting on the right provision at the right time? So are we training people for jobs that don't exist? That's not very useful. So how can we link up with employers, with the government, to actually get that place and time part right? And I mentioned equality and accessibility need to be at the heart of this. So the Just Transition Commission here in Scotland, they've done some brilliant work. They published their interim report recently, which I would recommend, looking at how COVID is, like I say, exacerbating some of these inequalities and how they might be addressed. And I guess with all of this, it's thinking about that place base, so thinking about the local narrative, but getting it right in terms of the national policy, and actually going back to our role as Scotland and the UK as hosts for this big climate conference next year, actually looking at what good global practice there is, but also looking at how we can share that good practice. And there's going to be, I hope, a lot of opportunity for that, certainly in the coming year. So just to finish, in terms of realising a green recovery and hopefully be a bit more positive. So there are some big uncertainties in terms of where we go on this. There's international politics on climate change. You know, what happens in the US election will be really, really important in terms of how much all the nations commit. So it won't just be what the US does, but that has sent a signal right around the world. But we've seen China actually come forward already with much more significant commitments on climate change. So that international politics side can be a real barrier, but it also can facilitate us as the UK and Scotland doing more. COVID-19 continues, as we all know, to be a big uncertainty in terms of what that will mean for how we live, how we react to things like climate change, where our priorities are, and the recession is part of that in terms of just our capacity to stop people falling out of employment and actually falling out of the loop in terms of delivering on net zero. So, you know, looking at those skills and those training packages in terms of avoiding long-term unemployment, giving opportunities for the young in particular, but also those who are finding themselves underemployed or unemployed in a lot of vulnerable sectors. We've got looming Brexit too, and that's going to, like I say, affect a lot of things, particularly around the agriculture sectors, has big concerns around there. But all of these things are, in my view, things which can be, at least in part, addressed through education. So I guess my main thread, hopefully, that's come through about 20 times already, in terms of realising a green recovery, at the heart of that is education. And it's not just skills and education for recovery, but it's for a green recovery. So it's really alignment with delivery of net zero, as well as getting us through this COVID crisis. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Glasgow Centre for Population Health podcast. If you'd like to find out more, search podcasts at gcph.co.uk.